our choices here are broken. As children grow, they grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are rampaging disease. In our minds we build the blocks to what we need. In our minds we're reaching out for peace. In our hearts we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts a sense of masterpiece.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who is a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And he also has an article at Salon.com, Guns Have Never Saved Us. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
And your article at Salon, Michael, explodes the myth that's a cherished myth amongst supporters of unlimited gun rights who cite the Second Amendment as empowering citizens to arm themselves. But what you're pointing out here, that it wasn't armed citizens who won our freedom in the American Revolution, and they've never been able to protect it subsequent to the American Revolution. You mentioned here, in fact, that during the American Revolution, it was actually the French soldiers fighting on American soil and the emigrant mercenaries who were signed up for pay and land that made the difference.
Yes, that's exactly right. There is this myth that a lot of hardy citizen soldiers who just grabbed their muskets off of their mantles above their fireplaces just ran out and then sent the British redcoats packing back home. In fact, the armies on both sides were largely paid professional soldiers from many different countries, particularly Ireland and Germany, were overrepresented. And in the case of the United States winning its independence from Britain, the U.S. had professional French armies, along with the help of the French Navy at sea, side by side with George Washington and his forces. So it's simply as cherished as it is as a myth among Americans, it's just not the case that citizen militias have played the crucial role, not only in the War of Independence, but in any other war. In the Civil War and in the two World Wars, a draft was necessary. It wasn't the state militias played only a negligible role. And in the early 20th century, the militias were more or less absorbed into the standing federal army in the form of the National Guard and Reserve units, which kind of made nonsense of the Second Amendment constitutional provision, which, if read properly, it says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the society of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So the Second Amendment does not envision individuals having guns against all levels of government, including the local county or city sheriff and police department. The well-regulated militia is the militia of the free state, that is, of one of the constituent states of the United States. And it was written at a time contemplating possible war between, you know, the state of Massachusetts and the state of South Carolina and the federal government, something which fortunately has not been an issue since the defeat of the Confederacy in the Civil War. It's difficult to see how anyone can get from reading the Second Amendment a right of individuals to bear, modern weapons of war, rather than simply an anachronistic reference to arming a state militia.
So the idea, the true story, not the cherished myth, that the individual American revolutionary took the musket off the fireplace and went out and drove the redcoats through the, ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes. I recall that song. Now, what was really happening, was it not, that the native farmers tended to drop out, as you point out, of the Continental Army. Is that why Tom Paine wrote that famous line about the Sunshine Patriots and the summer soldiers?
Yeah. And actually, they didn't even bring their weapons. They were issued weapons many of which were French weapons that the French were giving to the American colonists, because it was a war between France and Britain as much as a war between the American colonists and Britain. So they took their government-issued French muskets and bayonets, and then they took them home with them, and they never returned them, along with their uniforms. So there was a real problem where the farmers with families would drop out of the military. And so by the end of the war, George Washington was quite disgusted with the citizen soldiers, and he relied heavily on the professional mercenaries who were either landless American colonists who were in it in the hope of getting land and money, or else they were immigrants from Europe, some of them veterans of other 18th century wars. And they were whipped into shape under General von Steuben, who was a Prussian immigrant general. And they were led sometimes by foreign generals like Lafayette. So it really, the American Revolution, contrary to the popular myth, really looks a lot like the cabinet wars of the 18th century, the Seven Years' Wars, where you have kind of a multinational military force, both at the level of the soldiers and at the level of the officers. There were German emigre officers commanding both British forces and the American rebel forces in some cases. So this myth of the citizen soldier, which I should add, it's a myth on the populist left, as well as of the right. You know, this idea of gun ownership being a symbol of Republican virtue, it was shared by Tom Paine, whom the NRA quotes as an opponent of gun control, you know, for the reason that and before the French Revolution, the reactionary regimes in Europe forbade ordinary people to own weapons. That was a mark of aristocratic status. So there is a tradition in Western Europe itself, particularly in France and in Italy and in Switzerland, where there's something kind of like the gun culture in the United States on the left. It's not necessarily a reactionary thing. The pre-modern aristocrats had the exclusive right to bear arms and to hunt. And so quite logically, these smaller Republican progressives thought, well, if you have a democracy, then everyone should have the right to bear arms and also to hunt. The problem is these weapons that are being used in these mass killings, these are modern weapons of war. They're more like bazookas and landmines, you know, than they are like the sorts of rifles and shotguns that you need to hunt deer and doves. Nobody machine guns a deer. You know, nobody sprays automatic weapons fire on doves in dove hunting season. And I grew up in a family that hunted and you know, had hunting rifles and shotguns and so on. And, you know, there are safety concerns about it, obviously. But you can't massacre somebody with ordinary hunting guns. You really have to have these both semi-automatic rifles and also Glocks and similar pistols that have high-capacity cartridges where you just hold down the trigger and it just sprays out round after round after round, bullet after bullet. And there's really no reason why anyone would own such a weapon for recreational purposes unless your idea of recreation is going to a firing range and imagining that you're mowing people down like Arnold Schwarzenegger in a movie. To say that the Founding Fathers envisioned individuals having this kind of weapon, I think is particularly unlikely because, remember, one of the things they were trying to do with the federal government was to strengthen the central government against American rebels, like the Whiskey Rebels. And there was a that came after the Constitutional Convention. Between the American War of Independence and the adoption of the Federal Constitution in 1787-1788, there was Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts, where a lot of rural people rose up violently, although there weren't that many casualties, there were some, against tax collectors. And this was one of the things that motivated George Washington, who became the presiding officer at the Constitutional Convention, and others to meet to come up with a stronger, more centralized government, which, among other things, could keep a bunch of anti-tax rebels from terrorizing government officials, both state and federal. And then one of his necessary actions as President of the United States was to assemble. George Washington led more soldiers than he actually led in the American War of Independence at any one time, to in a show of force, to put down the Whiskey Rebellion, which was an anti-tax rebellion that was stimulated by excise taxes on whiskey to fund the national debt. So I really think if you went back and asked George Washington and Ben Franklin and James Madison if they thought the federal Constitution incorporated something that would allow the Whiskey Rebels and the members of Shays' Rebellion to have the most advanced high-tech weapons of war to use against their very own government, they would think that's absurd.
So I think you've very effectively exploded the myth that the Second Amendment defenders who misread our history, believing that armed citizens won our freedom and continue to protect it. We also have modern examples of the notion that you need to have the family machine gun in order to protect your liberty. What's happened, of course, recently with the Arab Spring in Egypt, Tunisia, for example, they're fairly glaring examples of peaceful rebellion against a military. And also, of course, going back a little further, Boris Yeltsin won the freedom for Russia from the communist regime, standing on a tank with peaceful demonstrators, not, you know, picking up a machine gun and going to war against the Red Army.
Yeah, well, let's be clear. The fact that the NRA misuses the example of popular rebellion does not mean that you don't have to have revolutions in some countries. And perhaps if you one day, you know, let's hope it doesn't happen, but, you know, over time, practically anything can happen. If there's a tyranny in the United States, then you may have to have a revolution against that. What we find in modern societies, as I point out, is that the swing vote, as it were, the deciding factor in modern successful revolutions tends to be the professional military. And the people play the role, the ordinary citizens, usually through nonviolent protests, one of the purposes of which is to persuade much or all of the military to break with the regime and to side with the people. So there is a place for citizens, but it's not as citizens spraying people with machine gun fire or engaged in hand-to-hand combat. It's risking their lives, and often they're slaughtered. They're often initially cut down by the forces of a tyrannical regime, but they can risk their lives and limbs in nonviolent Gandhi-like protests until, if the revolution is successful, the military turns against the regime and says, we're not going to gun down our siblings and our parents and our teachers and our neighbors. Now, sometimes that doesn't work. For example, in Iran it has not worked yet. In Syria it hasn't worked. It succeeded in Egypt. That was essentially the story of the downfall of communism in Russia and in the Soviet Empire. But given the weapons at the disposal of modern states, even fairly backward states, the idea that some ordinary householder, even if you have, you know, these Bushmaster, you know, military-type weapons, is going to hold out for long against a modern military, I think is just naive. And we don't actually, as I point out in my Salon piece, we don't have any contemporary examples of that. All of the major successful revolutions, it's true of the Orange Revolutions in Eastern Europe, it's true of the revolution against Ferdinand Marcos, it's this combination of the unarmed, peacefully protesting citizenry, and then of the professional military, which sides with the citizens against the regime.
Well, what explains, though, this anti-government paranoia in the United States that leads people to believe that they need the family machine gun to protect our liberties? It's both the alienation that a lot of Americans feel towards their government on the far right with the militia movement and the people that believe in black helicopters and the government wants to put a computer chip in your backside. And then you have on the left, you have all kinds of anti-government theories about the 9/11 conspiracy, etc., where they basically voluntarily, they feel alienation from the very government that they own. And of course, it's led to our pathetic politics where citizens aren't engaged. They've only half the people vote. and we have, we get the government we deserve.
Well, I think you have to distinguish the left and the right. There really is no longer a left-wing terrorist factions of any kind in the United States that's significant. Apart, there are some environmental vandals.
I'm not talking about revolutionary. I'm talking about anti-government paranoia. I don't mean the people acting on it.
No, but that's my point. The point I'm leading to is, if anyone had reason to be paranoid about the government, it would be African Americans and Latinos, right? And even Asian Americans, Japanese Americans put in concentration camps. There are not a whole lot of Black, Latino, and Asian militia members accumulating weapons. And in my view, race is at the center of all of this. That is, up until the Civil Rights Revolution, this kind of militia stuff was not a big deal among whites, particularly in the South, because the state government was the militia. The state government was enforcing the South African-type white supremacist apartheid regime. I don't think you can explain the militia movement as though it's different from white supremacy, given the enormous overlaps between the two. And what happened was the white supremacists, once they lost, the governments were no longer, at least the state governments, were no longer protecting white supremacy locally. They decided that the entire government, you know, in the old days, it was the federal government was the threat to white supremacy, but the state governments of Texas and Mississippi and Georgia were its allies. But once they lost the state and the local and the county and the city governments, I think that's when this modern militia movement, which is racist to the core, originated. So I don't think it's right simply to say this modern right-wing militia movement is the outgrowth of the old Scots-Irish, you know, frontier spirit of don't tread on me. Sure. You didn't have this sort of thing in the 1920s. You didn't have it in the 1950s because they had their friends were in the state house and in the state legislature and the state police. I don't think you can see this except as kind of a toxic consequence of the expiration of white supremacy in the United States. That's not to say that there aren't other violent groups.
Sure.
But most of these anti-government militia movements are deeply, deeply white supremacist.
So, Michael Lind, the president, of course, has just come out and suggested that he's going to really do something about gun violence in this country, and he's put Vice President Biden in charge of an effort to get all the government agencies cooperating, and he's vowing that this is not going to be some study that has a commission and then a few people read the study and then it gathers dust and nothing gets done. He's basically saying he's going to really try and get something done. But already the Republicans in the House, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has basically said no, they're not interested in gun control. And the Republican Party today is essentially controlled by the Tea Party wing, who sound a lot like the Whiskey Rebellion people, and they're driven by a combination of market fundamentalism and religious fundamentalism. So how do you get rid of, what do you do about this kind of toxic brew of market fundamentalism and religious fundamentalism that's captured one of the parties?
Well, I think the thing they all share, again, it's this post-white supremacist a disorientation of non-Hispanic whites who find themselves becoming a minority in their own country. And I think, like, the religious right, the Tea Party right, and the militia right, there's a high degree of overlap there. You cannot legitimately in the United States in 2012 have what they had, for example, in the 1950s, a white citizens' council. That's just completely forbidden, overt racism. But I think a lot of the so-called religious right, this gun subculture, it's really the white right. It's really the white supremacist right, or the white minority right, increasingly, in different parts of the country. And I think they just have to be defeated and outmaneuvered. So you go after their pressure points. You're not going to persuade these people. I mean, they're kind of like Afrikaners in modern South Africa. I mean, there's going to be some dwindling remnant. You know, their kids will get more liberal over time, but it's just going to be a while. So what you do is the pressure points are commercial. You outlaw the sale of these weapons to individuals, period. No one should be able to buy and use as a hobby a machine gun. Just forget it. You know, that should be outlawed any more than you can buy a rocket-propelled grenade launcher.
Sure.
You can't.
Well, but Michael...
And then you also use the shame. campaigns of boycotts and shame against these mainstream Wall Street investors and corporations that manufacture this stuff and market it. And I think, frankly, you also have to go after and have a name and shame campaign of this violent splatterpunk pornography. It's essentially murder pornography, these video games. You know, and I think the progressives have to decide, you know, are there any limits to libertarianism? And even if you don't want to use the action of the state to ban this stuff, there's nothing to prevent you from ostracizing this. And I don't, you know, frankly, I don't see why these violent video games should not be banned. I mean, if you had video games in which you were raping dozens of children, one after the other, and that was the game, then I think even most progressives would not object to a ban on that. But you have these video games where you're shooting people's heads off and blowing them up, and their guts are splattering everywhere. Why isn't that as obscene, really, in the most profound sense, as a rape game? I mean, it's a murder game.
Sure. Well, Michael, and just in closing, as we speak, of course, guns are flying off the shelf. I believe yesterday was a record day for the sale of firearms in the United States on the basis that the gun manufacturers are more or less signaling to the gun hoarders in this country that Obama's going to take away your guns. But as I mentioned, his proposals are already dead on arrival as far as the Republican House is concerned. Do you think that any laws will be enacted to, for example, restrict these assault weapons?
Well, you have to have somebody who's counting heads in Congress. There have been a number. Some Republicans have said that everything is on the table. Now, the problem with the U.S. constitutional system is there's so many pressure points that even these very tiny, ardent minorities can paralyze things. And so we will see. I mean, what's happened in the past is you've had these horrible massacres, and then the NRA and its allies rally, and they kill any reform. And so the United States is the only country where this kind of thing happens routinely. As it was pointed out, around the time of this latest massacre, a deranged individual in China attacked a class of school children with a knife with far less damage. So that I really think the debate has to focus on these weapons. I think it's a mistake to denounce guns as such, because there is a legitimate role, you know, for hunting. Now, the irony is, in most states, including most southern states, you have to take a firearms class before you can get a hunting license. But you don't have to get a license before you actually buy a gun, right? So I think that if you distinguish legitimate hunting from illegitimate machine gun ownership, and, you know, the self-defense of the home thing is, you know, frankly kind of dubious. As I understand the statistics of it, I'm not an expert, but it's not clear that having guns in the home to protect yourself, that, you know, that's going to be a harder sell. Sure. I think, you know, guns for household defense. But you know, everything should focus on these particular kinds of machine guns. So it's not just gun control in general. It's machine gun control. And I think you will be able to build a consensus for the automatic weapons and the high-capacity cartridges more easily than for just trying to go against all guns of all kinds.
Well, Michael Lind, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. He has an article at Salon.com, Guns Have Never Saved Us. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the findings of a report by an independent panel who investigated the Benghazi incident. Happiness is a